It's time to start. So thank you. Everybody put your masks on. I'll take mine off and you put them on. And if you remember, it says out there, mask up. So if your mask is down, you're not following the rules, okay? Please. And just for the consideration of everybody else, I know it's uncomfortable. I know it steams up the glasses, but you know, we do it anyway, out of the love for one another. So thank you, everybody. I'm allowed to have mine off, right?
I understand.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I wanted to say thank you to you for yesterday when at lunch at the Food for Thought, each table had one of the myths. And from what I can hear, oh, I forgot to put the mic on, sorry. Speaking of hearing, from what I can hear, you all, or many of the tables had good conversations. Mm-hmm. And those myths are not simply the sort of thing that you can say, oh, that's not true, and move on, because many of them are things that we've heard for a long time, and not just from known bigots, but from loving, caring people who said some of these things in a loving, caring way. So I started out my presentation a couple days ago by saying, I'm not an expert, and I'm not. And I continue not to be an expert. But, so if you want to explore further any of those myths, do it. I hope that your conversation at your table made you want to explore your myth further, and perhaps some of the other myths as well. And of course, one way to do that is to read that book that it's taken from. But you can also explore in other ways. And I would encourage you, if this is of interest to you, to continue exploring those myths. So I'm going to start us today with the reading of a translation of a psalm. It's Psalm 85, and it is paraphrased by Marcienne Vroon Rienstra in an overtly feminist treatment of the psalms called The Swallow's Nest. This is a psalm of lament. And remember, we're talking about what happened after the National Indian Lutheran Board brought together lots and lots of American Indians and even some Lutherans, and Lutherans diligently raised money and gave out $200,000 a year. And it culminated in 1988 when the National Indian Lutheran Board was dissolved and became part of that new church for which we had such hope. And I'm sorry if I'm snarky. Listen to the paraphrase of the psalm. There was a time, O God, when you favored this land and restored the fortunes of your people. You forgave the wrongdoing and pardoned all their sin. You withdrew your wrath and your hot indignation cool. Restore us again, O God of our salvation. Why are you still angry with us? How long will your anger persist? Will it last through all generations? Revive us again, that we, your people, may find joy in you. Show us your steadfast love, O God, and make us whole and holy. Listen with me while El Shaddai speaks. She speaks peace to her people, to the faithful, to those who return to her with heartfelt repentance. All who are devoted to her will surely and soon be free, free to dwell in a land once more filled with her beauty and bounty. Let loving kindness and truthfulness meet. Let mercy and honesty embrace one another. Let faithfulness spring like grass from the earth,
and justice rain down from the sky. Let righteousness make a way for her, and integrity a path for her feet. El Shaddai, be good to us. Then our land will be fruitful and peaceful again. And there are other places in this book of paraphrases where she translates El Shaddai as the many-breasted one, which is another feminine image. So, the topic today is a brief history of the ELCA and American Indians and Alaska Natives. And really, we're going to talk about how we got from 1988, that hope we ended up with yesterday, to 2021, where I think there is some hope again. And I just put some dates up there and some dates of what was going on in the church, which I understand you can't read, sorry, and some dates of things that were going on in the United States government, and in one case, 2007, the United Nations. And that's just because I thought it was a good idea to put it up there. I'm sorry you can't read it. In 1988, the ELCA was formed as a merger of the American Lutheran Church, the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches, and the Lutheran Church in America. And the hope was, the plan was, as we heard on the documentary yesterday, that the National Indian Lutheran Board, with its wonderful track record, with its credibility in Indian country, with its ability to raise funds from ordinary congregations and distribute them to people who needed it, with all kinds of accountability, the plan was for that to be absorbed into the ELCA, with the understanding that the ELCA would carry forth its work. Trying not to be nasty. How do I say this here? I don't think there was a nefarious plan to make it not happen. Even in my most cynical moments, I don't think there was a nefarious plan to thwart the mission of the National Indian Lutheran Board. But as we know, the formation and the transformation and the reshuffling of the deck chairs of great institutions takes a huge amount of energy. And some things get lost along the way. And as I was thinking about this, trying to be generous of spirit, I remembered that an organization that I belonged to for a number of years was called the Lutheran Women's Caucus. The Lutheran Women's Caucus was started by women in the Missouri Synod who felt like there was no place for them in the Missouri Synod. And they had long histories, and maybe their husbands and fathers and grandfathers and brothers and sons were all pastors. And so they weren't going to leave the Missouri Synod, but they needed an anchor. And so they started this Lutheran Women's Caucus, this organization of feminist Lutherans. And it had women from all different Lutheran denominations. And in 1988, the Lutheran Women's Caucus went dormant again because the ELCA had a commission for women, and both Jean and I served on that board at separate times, and because the ELCA had, you know, a commitment to gender equity throughout the church and also the organization of the women of the ELCA, the thought was, well, you know, that work will be kind of incorporated in that. And I remember arguing with the Lutheran Women's Caucus against that, saying, yes, but we leave behind our Missouri Synod sisters and our Wisconsin Synod sisters and our Lutheran brethren sistren, et cetera. And in fact, but that happened. So it's kind of a parallel thing. It's not just that the ELCA tried to stiff the native folks. It's the creation of an institution, I think, that was complicated. When the ELCA was formed, there was a Commission for Multicultural Ministries, which basically meant non-white. And there was a director of the Commission for Multicultural Ministries, and there was a large board that met a couple of times a year for the Commission of Multicultural Ministries. And under that, and I'm saying under because it was pretty hierarchical, there were desks, and there was the African American desk, and there was the Asian American desk, and there was the and Pacific Islander, and there was the I forget what they called it, but we'll say Latinx desk, and then there was the Native American desks. And there were those four desks. There was a director of American Indian and Alaska Natives. There were, in 1988, Native congregations across the church, as there were before 1988, and as there continue to be. And the additional structure that was also set up to provide some accountability was the American Indian Alaska Native Association, which still exists. Joanne Conroy is the chair. She's a pastor in St. Paul. It still exists. I would not say it has any of the power that the NILB had, but it still exists. At the beginning of the ELCA, we also, as a church, made a commitment to be at least 10% people of color and language other than English in the first 10 years. Didn't happen. My father used to say, well, why don't we just get rid of a bunch of white people? Which we actually did, but it still didn't happen. We also had in our constitutions of the churchwide and the synods and the congregations a commitment to have at least 10% of all committees and boards and any structures be 10% people of color. That didn't happen either, and it's no longer there in the Constitution. So what we lost when we lost the National Indian Lutheran Board, we lost this place of Native leadership. We lost the Sunday fundraisers. I mean, maybe it was corny. And, you know, when we started the ELCA, we had this idea that money would flow to the national, the churchwide headquarters for all things. And if you had a particular passion for children in Thailand, or if you had a particular passion for Native American issues, or a particular passion for Sunday school materials, you didn't give to that. You all gave to one thing, and then the money would go back out to these things. That didn't work either. Before the ELCA, both the ALC and the LCA had Native Americans Concerns Sundays, and it was usually the last Sunday in November, and the congregation took an offering, and that's what provided the $200,000 that was given away every year. We no longer did that. And gosh, it didn't get replaced in some other way. We lost that connection with Indigenous people whose main connection with our church was not their membership or their ethnic background or their last name, but through those grants, through the NILB. So we lost that. We lost some credibility in Indian country that we had because we were in partnership through the National Indian Lutheran Board. And I think one of the things that we did as a church, and it's what everybody did at the time, we weren't being, you know, intentional jerks about it, but it's just, it's what it was. We treated American Indians, Alaska Natives, as a minority. It's a minority group. We have these four minority groups. We didn't treat them as a sovereign nation. And I think that's one of the fundamental problems behind everything. So there it was, 1988. Some of you were involved in church at the time and may recall that it was a time of great upheaval and lots and lots of things going on. That's the first date I have written up here for those of you who can't see. The second date is 1997. In 1997, the ELCA put together an American Indian Alaska Native strategic plan, which was adopted by the Churchwide Assembly and, you know, became what we pointed to when it was asked, well, what are you guys doing about American Indians? And I'm going to read you from the beginning of it. The Lutheran Witness with American Indians and Alaska Natives has more than 350 years of history. It is a history filled with hope and broken promises, solidarity and injustice, affirmation and paternalism, strategies and inaction, grand goals and lack of funding. With this conflicting legacy, we enter the 1990s. At the end of 1994, the ELCA American Indian Alaska Native membership was 6,685, while ELCA general membership declined 1.7% between 87 and 94. American Indian and Alaska Native membership increased by 18.1% during that same period, et cetera. So that's the beginning of it. I want to read you the vision of it. And here's an anecdote, which I think is about you, Darius. I'm not sure, but it seems like when you came into your position in the Montana Synod as whatever it was called, mission director, et cetera, et cetera, you looked at a population map of the state of Montana, and you saw, in addition to sort of the obvious Bozeman, Missoula, Billings growth spots, you saw these rural hot spots of growth. They were all reservations. That's where growth was taking place. Not Lutheran growth, but that's where growth was taking place. Okay, in the vision of this 1997 document, American Indians and Alaska Natives are a people created by God, redeemed by Jesus Christ, and sanctified by the Holy Spirit. We give unique expression to our faith as we proclaim the good news, share in the ministry of word and sacrament, participate in the mission of reconciliation with God and God's creation, seek justice for all people, and celebrate diversity within Christ's unifying love. In all these ways, we nurture American Indian and Alaska Native peoples, their congregations and communities, and the church. So that is that sort of begins the vision. It's a rather long document, as we're really good at long documents, aren't we, in our church? We really do that well. Sometimes they're just lengthy, and other times they take forever to write, as well as being really long. The focus of this document, this strategy, it was fourfold. One focus was on congregational development. At the time, we had 21 Native congregations, and a focus was on, getting more congregations, because that's what the ELCA tried to do, is get more congregations. And, a downside of that is the model for starting new congregations at the time was not something that necessarily worked in Indian country. You know, it was kind of a model that maybe worked well in a suburb of a growing city, but really not so well in Indian country. You just need something different for that. But congregational development was one focus. A second focus was leadership development. And, we continue to work with that. At the time, it was really leadership development for the church. And God knows we need good leadership development in the church. We need leadership development in communities, whether or not they are the church. Public advocacy was a third focus. And the fourth focus was social ministry, feeding the hungry and, those sorts of good things. So as I look with my advantage of hindsight, as I look at that document, what I see is the main flaw is that there was too much reliance on the department will do this. There was too much reliance on staff. And all four of these foci were supposed to be done by the department, which in reality was one person. And one person can't do all that. I'm sure many of you have been in situations too where you were the one person who was supposed to make everything happen. And it's a recipe for failure. I want to read you a piece of the document, which is very interesting. It says, the American India and Alaska Native Strategic Plan is a call for change that American Indians and Alaska Natives hope the church will embrace wholeheartedly. And then this next sentence. Growth in all four planning areas must occur for American Indians and Alaska Natives to realize fully their role within the ELCA and to strengthen their communities in service to God. And that particular sentence appears verbatim several times in this document. But maybe I'm just being a snarky editor. But notice that it's talking about what they must do to prepare for their role in our church. Okay? Just, 20-some years later, it's a little jarring. There were actually kind of limited goals in this document. One was to stimulate forward thinking and clarify future directions of the department. And I think by 1997, we knew that we weren't going to be growing staff. We'd already had the downturn in the early 90s when the sexuality statement came out and money went away. Improving performance within the department, again, the one person. And then to help American Indian Alaska Native congregations survive, even thrive, within the body of this church. The 21 congregations in this much, much larger church. So, that was 1997. In 2003, we came up with another document. Some of you may have seen this. It's called A Vision of Partnership and Unity. And it was put together, the lead was ELCA, Marilyn Sorensen, who was she was the single department person for many years. But it was not simply ELCA. The United Church of Christ and the Presbyterians were involved in this too. Remember how I talked about early on some of the Lutheran attempts were sort of ecumenical joint failures, and we too joined in and failed. But still, we were working with other Protestants at the time. So this is a good step forward to be working with other Protestant groups who weren't at the time, but now are part of, they're in full communion with us. So I want to read a little bit from the larger story. It says, we are the living descendants of God's children who have lived in this hemisphere for tens of thousands of years. We are here today. As we change, we honor our ancestors and the land they have known. We also take care of the generations who will follow us. We have always been a spiritual people, being deeply aware of the Creator's presence among us and among God's other creatures. Our elders have passed on respect and beautiful ways of living. We're also followers of Jesus and his way of peace. Thus, we continue to be a people of prayer who know the power of worship. Later on, as the authors from these three denominations talk to us, non-Native allies, they say this, and I think it's pretty important. As partners for justice and wholeness, we ask that you go beyond deeper understanding to informed action. Action that must always be with and not for Indian people. History has revealed many friends, often in the churches, who have harmed our people despite the best of intentions. It's a common human principle that those affected by decisions should share in those decisions more than any other people. However, Indians have had policies made for them, not with them. The entire U.S. government, up until 78 when some things got a little bit better. Such decisions and policies have almost always been unwise. So, you know, I think that that's just a really, really important reminder.
Where did that come from?
That came from here, from the Presbyterians, UCCs, and ELCA. Native people writing that, not well-intentioned allies, but sort of saying, thank you, now shut up and listen. Listen, really listen, you know what I mean? Yeah, so that's in here. This is a really nice resource, sort of gently tells the awful story. Maybe you can just see the dark and the light in here in this picture of the United States. This would be 1481. The dark means lands that were native lands. And it goes down, and here is 1977. So just kind of the change. And I was shocked to learn that in Canada, there are far, far fewer lands that Native people have, that all of the Canadian reserves together are a little smaller than the Navajo Reservation. We always think Canada's way ahead of us in these areas, and they are in many ways, but not so much in that one.
Can you tell us the title of that again?
It's called A Vision of Partnership and Unity.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
When did that come out?
2003. And, you know, God knows with all the reorganizations whether there are any copies available, but I'm sure, you know, synod offices should have them, and you can make copies of them. I think the copyright has probably expired. Yes, sir? Do you think it has, Turner?
I think that's true.
All right. Turner used to do copyright law, so he'll be our expert. So, and one of the useful things I think that they do in here is to talk about different policies in a sort of gentle way, the different policies that our government has had over the years. The policy of good faith in 1787. The policy of removal in the 1830s. The policy of conquest post-Civil War with Manifest Destiny and the Indian Wars is sort of how that was manifested. The policy of assimilation in 1887. The policy of the invisible and forgotten Indian in 1910. The policy of reform in 1934. The policy of termination after World War II. The policy of self-determination in the 1960s, and then activism, kind of after that. And some of these are some U.S. policies. I started in 1978, since I'm sort of trying to do parallel to the beginning of the ELCA, but 1978 was the Indian Child Welfare Act. And that was, one of the effects of that was to make it extremely difficult for non-Indian families to adopt Indian children, sort of cutting off that effect of the boarding schools, of taking folks away from their heritage. I recently got an email saying that a certain case is actually threatening that, so I'm not sure about that. Yes? Yes? American Religious Freedom Act? In 1978, I mean, we think of people coming here for the freedom of religion, not till 1978 for American Indians. IGRA, I forget what that is. In 1988, that was, what was that? Oh, Oh, Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. There was the Native Games Protection and Repatriation Act. The Religious Freedom. Anyway, lots and lots of acts eventually got passed. Any of you know who Steve Charlson is? He's a Native American. He taught at Luther Seminary for a while. Then he went to Alaska. He was an Episcopal bishop in Alaska. He's also written some really interesting books, some sort of theological and spiritual books about Native spirituality. And then he's written some really strange book, a series called, starts with The Bishop of Mars. It's a you know, futuristic kind of a thing. And then he's got the Madonna of Mars and the Tao of Mars. So they're really interesting, but not really relevant to this. He was involved in this, and he wrote, and I found this a little odd, Native Americans are among those who want to be integrated, not just included in the ELCA. I'm not sure how that works with the whole "we don't want to be assimilated" that we heard yesterday. He says, "All inclusiveness is only a first step towards integration in Jesus Christ. Identity and integrity are key words. Lutherans must continue to work against stereotypes and racism. Its future depends on that." Among the issues that are identified by the Native people in three denominations in this book include the first one being tribal sovereignty and federal trust responsibility. And, you know, that's a thing that, I don't know about you, but when I start hearing those words, you know, I kind of glaze over. You know, it used to be when I would see sports in the newspaper, I'd kind of glaze over. Or agriculture, glaze over. Living in Montana, I had to learn about agriculture. And since our newspaper no longer prints anything, I sometimes read the sports because it at least talks about, you know, little towns that I used to go to. But that's a tribal sovereignty and federal trust responsibility. What are those relationships between those sovereign nations and the federal government that it's so easy to gloss over? And what are those relationships? What are those obligations? And how do we counter when people around us casually say things that are really wrong, that are making the assumption that, oh, they're just getting something for nothing? And, you know, how do we talk about that? How do we do that? And then what about the unrecognized tribes? And how are we partners without having them have to sign the guest book and go through a new member training, you know? Are we willing to be partners with people who aren't willing to do new member training? Or even come inside our doors? Because coming inside our doors can be very traumatic. I told you how I kind of got into this and doing some immersion events with Native leaders. There were several who had a very difficult time coming into the retreat center, which was an old Catholic school, convent, who literally got stopped at the door because they had such a bad experience as children with the church. So how do we keep track of that? That's the first issue, just small issue. The second is land and resources. And, you know, we're beginning to hear more about that as we're hearing more about controversies over sacred lands and over pipelines and how it is that, you know, should this be a national monument or should it not? And who gets to decide? Another issue, strong issue, is families. And, you know, so many families are dysfunctional and broken. And in large part, that's an effect of people generations ago being taken away and brought up in boarding schools. And many of them died. But those who survived, they missed their childhood. They missed knowing what a mama does to a child, what a father does with a child. They had only the people running the boarding schools. And even in the best of the boarding schools that were the least abusive and where the children weren't sexually assaulted, how's that for a low bar? Even those children were denied understanding how to be parents. And so, yes, if they did go back, in many cases, they couldn't fit in and could not go back to the family structure. So families is a really important issue. Health and wholeness is a really important issue. I mean, the statistics on the lifespan of Native people, you know, 10 years or more less than everybody else in this country. COVID hit reservations really, really, really hard, and elders died. I found it interesting in Montana, actually, that the tribes were really with it. They were really on it and were immediately vaccinating first the elders. And nobody butted in line ahead of the elders saying, well, I need to do it because I'm important. The sense of family and the great respect for elders and even, well, I'm a young brave and I don't need it, I'm fine, which, you know, we hear a lot of young men and young women who are white saying, you know what, I'm fine. No, you didn't hear that on the reservations. For the sake of my community, I will be doing it. So, you know, there's one good piece of news in terms of health. As a matter of fact, on the Blackfeet Reservation, they got so many people vaccinated that they had extra, and they got permission to do vaccinations across the border because the Blackfeet tribe becomes the Blackfoot tribe in Canada. Same people. But, you know, just that crazy border there. And they were able to do vaccinations in Canada, which was way behind at the time. And the Blackfoot folks got vaccinated. And then they just said, well, anybody can come. So, you know, kind of cool that people were driving from Calgary and Edmonton down to the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana because they believed in health. So that's kind of interesting. Economic development is another one of the issues, and you've seen efforts. We saw some wonderful economic development projects yesterday on that documentary. Education. There are now a lot more tribal colleges than there were. There's just a lot more tribal colleges, and we've got one on every reservation in Montana. The newest one, the Little Shell, who just got recognized a year and a half ago, they don't have a tribal college, but the others do. Some of you may know Christine Holler Dinsmore. She's now an ELCA pastor. She was a science professor at the Fort Peck Tribal College and taught her students and took her students to science competitions around the country, and they loved it when they beat out the students from the Ivy League. You know, yes.
How are they funded, the colleges?
Huh, anybody know that? There is some federal funding that comes to it and some grants, and that's about all. That'll be your assignment, your research assignment. Issues of justice. And you know, one of the crazy things is about on-res versus off-res, and what the reservation police can do and what they can't do, and having to bring in the feds for, you know, bigger crimes, etc. So that's complicated and sort of evolving. Sacred sites and religious freedom. We talked about that a little bit, and then images and stereotypes. So that all was in this important book from 2003. In 2005, the ELCA put together something that they called the Indigenous Institute, and Darius was part of that. It was for bishops and synod leaders. Darius was a mission developer,
director.
For Montana Synod and Eastern Washington, Idaho Synod. And this was a way to try to get people, not just in the grassroots, but at the highest level of power, He was once at the highest level of power. But to give them some real connection in Indian country, so they went to the National Congress of American Indians, which is an amazing thing. And by the way, I participated in that once last year. Of course, it was by Zoom. But we did. We started with the blessing that is in braiding sweetgrass. And it was all Native people doing it, of course, and it was just stunning. So this Indigenous Institute was another thing that the ELCA was trying to do to get the attention of bishops and mission directors and assistants to bishops and folks like that, to get their attention on Native issues, because generally in society, our attention was not on Native issues. And the hope was, well, maybe this is a way to get people's attention. And so that happened for a couple of years. In 2007, the United Nations adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, or UNDRIP. How do you like that? It's kind of a pathetic kind of thing. It had 40... What does that mean? What is it? Oh, okay, fine. It has 46 articles, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and it was signed by almost everybody, but not Canada or the U.S. or New Zealand or Australia. So it went too far. It, you know, wait a minute, rights, you know, that's one thing, but, you know, So you can take a look at it. You can find it online, or I have it actually here in pink. And Canadians have, I know the Canadian Church, Lutheran Church, has asked the government to, would you please endorse this? But as far as I know, they haven't. I haven't really kept up on everything Canadian. That was a really important thing for the United Nations to do. And, you know, we stand alone, or almost alone, in not having signed it. In 2011, there was a resolution to the church-wide assembly. And this resolution, see if I can find it. This resolution basically said, you know, there really aren't that many American Indians in leadership in the ELCA, and not many folks here at the churchwide assembly. And given that we are trying to do a better job at this kind of thing as a church, how about if we commit to inviting tribal leaders to any event that the ELCA does in their territory? And also have an educational component at every event sponsored by the churchwide organization. Global mission events, youth gatherings, etc., etc., etc. So that was sort of the gist of the resolution. You can't just stand up and make a resolution. Resolutions go through, you know, a vast process. And the Memorials Committee said, the Reference and Council Committee suggested that this motion be referred, which is to say, we won't vote yes or no, but we'll refer it to the people in charge, to the, you know, to the staff people. And the maker of the motion was okay with that, because at least it had been brought up and it would supposedly go to somebody who had some power to do something. And people spoke generally in favor of referral. One person, who is a known liberal, but not in this room, it says, spoke in favor of the recommendation to refer, saying it was important to understand the plight of Native Americans. Which, you know, looking back kind of makes me go, ugh. So having understood the plight of Native Americans, the Yes, right. The assembly voted to refer to folks who would do something, 2011. In 2013, the person who made the resolution in 2011 came back with another resolution. And this one had more teeth in it. I'm guessing that maybe that first one that got referred to people who could do something just kind of died. That happens. So this next time, the resolution went farther and did all the whereases about how we want to be a welcoming sort of committee, and said that the ELCA, the resolve was that the ELCA will become a leader in the area of advocacy and active support, that the ELCA will endorse UNDRIP, even though we're not members of the United Nations, that we would endorse it, that we would have the presiding bishop write to the president of the United States and demand all kinds of things, and that we would start funding again as we used to fund, and on and on and on. And the Reference and Council Committee said, you know, I think it would be good if we referred this to the people who can do stuff like that. And so there was conversation back and forth. And whereas in 2011, the maker of the resolution said, yeah, I think referring is a good idea. This time he said, please don't. Please vote on it here and now. And there was more back and forth. And I happened to notice that I was one of the people who opposed the motion to refer. Yes. Good to know. Because I'm sure there's lots of mistakes that I've made that are probably in other kinds of minutes. But the assembly listened to the Reference and Council Committee and in its wisdom voted to refer once again. So, you know, this is not to say that any of these are horrible people. This is kind of how things happen.
Or don't.
In institutions, you know, it's just kind of what goes on. So, I need to get moving here. So, that was 2011 and 2013. In 2012, and remember that in 2004, the United States Congress apologized, even though it was hidden in secret, they did. In 2010, the president apologized, even though it was really In 2012, I happened to be on the ELCA Church Council as chair of the Conference of Bishops, and the president had just made a proclamation about indigenous peoples' recognition, and just while we were meeting. And so I got the ELCA Church Council in 2012 to proclaim for the ELCA as well as for the United States, that it was indigenous peoples' recognition. And, you know, that was a small thing, but at least something happened. So, moving on, in 2015, we as a church began to do some work on the repudiation of the doctrine of discovery. I remember being asked as a bishop, there were two of us who were asked to write on it, and one was an Indian bishop, and one was a non-Indian bishop. And we actually, I don't know if Guy actually ever did write, but he meant to. And anyway, I did. And several years later, as I was preparing for this, I wanted to look back at it and to see how embarrassed I would be by what I'd written in my naivete before I knew about all this papal bull and all that kind of stuff. And actually, it was pretty good, so I'm not embarrassed, not ashamed. And we all start somewhere, and that was it. In terms of repudiations of the doctrine of discovery from other denominations, the Episcopal Church did it in 2009, the World Council of Churches, the Unitarians, the United Church of Canada, and the United Methodist Church did it in 2012, 2013, the United Church of Christ. In 2016, the ELCA and the Presbyterians and the Christian Reformed, and 2017, it was the Disciples of Christ. So in 2016, we got our act together more or less as a denomination. Someone wrote kind of a boilerplate resolution to go out to Synod Assemblies. And somebody might want to close those doors. And different synods, tweaked it in their own way so that they would see, so they could put their own thing. We added, when we did it in the Montana Synod, we added information about how we had done an apology and taken it around to various tribes. 18 synods passed resolutions and sent them on to the churchwide assembly. I know of at least one where they considered it and did not send it on, in the Nebraska Synod. And there may have been others, but friends of mine in the Nebraska Synod were heartbroken that it didn't go on. They have at least one Native congregation there, and that's very hurtful, when it doesn't get passed on. I was delighted that our synod passed it on. And in the handout that I gave you yesterday, the front page of it with the gray bar up at the top, that is the resolution that came out of the ELCA churchwide assembly that was passed with 97% voting yes. And so it wasn't the identical resolution that were submitted from all these 18 synods, but it was the resolve was to do these things. And if you have it, pull it out. Because the resolution was to repudiate explicitly and clearly the European-derived doctrine of discovery, to offer a statement of repentance and reconciliation, to encourage the office of the presiding bishop to plan an appropriate national ceremony, to direct the domestic mission unit along with American Indian Alaska Native community, to develop resources, to direct the domestic mission unit, to develop a strategy with the American Indian Alaska Native community during the next triennium, and to affirm that this church will eliminate the doctrine of discovery from its contemporary rhetoric and programs. That is what we promised, and immediately did nothing. It's not funny. He's heard me say this before. Because within a month of our adopting this, Standing Rock exploded into the news. We had just promised to stand with Native people. We were asked to stand with Native people. We did not until it was too little and too late. And these are my biases speaking, in case you hadn't noticed. Because really, Standing Rock was a turning point for me. I mean, it's not that I went and lived there for, 12 weeks or anything like that. But the ELCA had an opportunity immediately to live out the intent of the repudiation. And we squandered it. Early on, representatives of other churches were there. Early on, before the judge made a decision, when people there were begging church leaders to make a statement in support, we had the opportunity and didn't do it. It was more than a month later that an okay statement came out of 8765 West Higgins Road. But it was too little and too late. Our presiding bishop, and a good friend of mine, knows how mad I am still, was, and knows all this, was too influenced by the settlers, by the landowners, by the extraction people, by the sensibilities of those who had so much to lose. And we're talking about, what are you willing to lose? So we did eventually get a statement, and At the time, I was furious about it because I saw the draft of the original statement that was supposed to go out early on, and I thought it was too moderate, but others thought it was too radical. When the statement finally did come out, you know, 6 weeks too late, I was furious. I've looked back at it, and it's not as totally wimpy as I had called it. But, you know, it wasn't quite, there's good people on both sides kind of a letter, but I kind of saw it through that lens to begin with, so that's my confession. Did any of you go to Standing Rock? It was an amazing kind of a thing. I mean, there were people from all over the world. I saw Palestinian flags. I saw a Blackfeet flag. I saw the flag of the Episcopal Church. Now, I'm really glad that the ELCA doesn't have a flag, but still, you know. It was a turning point. It was the largest gathering of Native people in the United States ever. There were people from all over, and then people from around the world. So I think it was a turning point for our country in some ways, in which these issues, the connection between Native people and a pipeline, became really obvious, even to the densest of us. Like, oh, yeah, okay. So I think it was a turning point for Native issues in this country. It was a turning point for me, and a turning point for the ELCA, because there were a number of ELCA people who were there and were really active and really disappointed. So from 2016 to 2019, going back to this thing we promised, the follow-up work was not done. It was not done by the bishop's office, was not done by the domestic unit. There were all kinds of reasons, but and there were even regular reports on the nothing that had not been or had been not done, you know, and there's no health in us. But basically, nothing had been done. And, you know, I look at the reports, and I've probably been guilty of this one in my administrative bureaucratic years as well, but there were vast reports, and basically they said nothing. And, you know, the person reported to this about that, and then this, and then they formed a task force, and then they were going to report, but then this, you know, and it was just basically nothing had been done. You can read the minutes, and it's nothing. There was no public event, as was promised. There were no educational materials, as were promised. There was no extensive effort to dig into everything that we've got, to find evidence of the doctrine of discovery and remove it. There were no efforts to include American Indian, Alaska Native issues in our anti-racism work. Well, we said we're against racism towards anybody. But the work was not relevant at all. And there was no intentional coordination with our fine advocacy folks in Washington, D.C., and in some of the states where there are ELCA advocacy people who are actually paid to do the work. Some great work happened, but there was no intentional focusing of that. So we had, once again, as a primarily white institution, failed to keep our promises, failed to honor our neighbors, failed to stand with them, failed to take responsibility for our failure. Blech. Monday night was the culmination of some change. And we're going to be talking tomorrow. My topic is unfinished business, and it's what some of us have been doing since 2019. Frankly, like the widow with the unjust judge, I just kept bugging the presiding bishop, with whom I have more than 40 year relationship. And I was her supervisor, so there was that. but I just kept bugging her from 2016 until 2019 when I was about to retire, and she finally said, "Would you please take this on in your retirement?" So I thought it over for half a second and said, "Absolutely." So we'll deal some with some of that tomorrow. Questions, comments? You know, you got 30 seconds. Anybody? Yes.
As a native Nebraskan,
yes,
I probably paid more attention to the Homestead Act because that's where it started. The date for the Homestead Act was 1862. If you think about it, there was a lot going on in this country. Civil War, primarily.
That kind of thing, yeah.
But that the president was proclaiming Homestead Act, et cetera, et cetera. In the middle of the Civil War, I assume meant that we were taking over everything to the West, and in case there was any question about whether or not Indians were accepted, probably that gave permission for them to be kicked out further off somewhere, so this white privilege...
Keep on. Yeah. Paul's talking, if you didn't hear him, he's talking about the Homestead Act, and signed in the middle of the Civil War, and the impetus for white people to go west. And, you know, the impetus wasn't, for most people, primarily it wasn't, let's go deprive Indians of their land and kill them while we're at it. It was, we need a place. And, you know, a lot of Europeans came here not because, well, they were desperate, so, you know.
And so, they had to push the immigrants away from us, too.
Right. Okay, yes.
There was one time when the Lutherans did stand with the Indians, and that was in the Bolt decision.
Okay.
And that was really interesting because it was a Scandinavian fisherman who had six sons who also became fishermen, and the whole process was over fish and fishing. But the Lutherans were there.
And what was the, do you know the year of that?
I can't remember the year, but Bolt decision, B-O-L-T.
And that would have been in the Pacific Northwest?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, not a plains type issue.
Not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for that. Appreciate that. Yeah.
What is the Lutheran Church's position on teaching in public schools and reservations? The Native American culture and whatnot, as a, and along with the broader history. And I can put another way, what if you were the superintendent of the schools in Browning or Pablo?
Mm-hmm.
How would you balance that, or would you?
It seems to me that teaching culturally appropriate, that would be a no-brainer, that would be, I would be in favor of it. I wouldn't fall, you know, we are very much separation of church and state and, you know, nothing religious in public schools, and I would go for that in the Great Falls Public Schools. In Native culture, it seems like it's much more integrated. And so, you know, they easily talk about God, and they have, you know, flags that it's a different mix. And I would, first of all, if I were superintendent, I would I'd try to shut up and listen a lot, but and talk to other superintendents who are dealing with that, or to the parents and see. So suppose there's an atheist who's there, you know, are they going to sue us? Is the ACLU going to come in and sue us over that? I don't know. It'd be interesting, though, wouldn't it? What would you do?
I'd try to find the correct